This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Repeal, delay, we've got a new CBO score. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, July 19th. Good to have you with us. The CBO released a new score for the Republican plan to repeal Obamacare and replace it later. Bottom line, repealing would lead to 32 million without insurance by 2026. The CBO said the repeal could decrease federal deficits by $473 billion from 2017 through 2026. For more, we've got Sarah Cliff from Vox with us now on the phone. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When you look at the new score, what stands out to you?
So the thing that stands out to me most is this is a score of what's called a repeal and delay bill the Republicans have proposed, where they repeal Obamacare now, but they don't have most of it take effect until 2020. And what jumped out at me is that the drop in insurance coverage, it really isn't delayed, that 17 million people will lose coverage next year alone under this bill, mostly because the mandate to carry health coverage would go away.
What's the plan mean to premiums? What are we seeing there?
Really big increases in premiums. So the CBO projects that premiums would double over the next decade, as you'd see a lot of healthy people exit the market because they don't have to buy insurance, and you'd be stuck with a lot of sick people with high health care needs purchasing coverage.
How's this score change the conversation going forward, do you think?
So, you know, this bill is in a bit of a funny place. We don't expect it to pass when it comes to a vote next week. You've already had a number of senators say they don't like the idea of repealing Obamacare without a replacement ready. And I think it just throws a little more cold water on it. It suggests that you can't really just rip Obamacare out without a replacement. It is so entrenched at this point that you need to offer something to the people who rely on it for coverage.
What's the path forward here? I mean, how do the Republicans move forward from this score?
That is an excellent question that I'm sure is going to keep Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell up tonight. You know, we do have right now, as we speak, a handful of moderate senators, Republicans, who are huddling on Capitol Hill talking about what to do about Medicaid. So there certainly are discussions going on, but the path forward is very, very narrow at this point. It's really hard to see how Senate Republicans pull off passing a bill at this point. And it probably will not be this repeal and delay bill that just got this pretty terrible CBO score.
What could they do at this point? I mean, do you think there are steps they could take to win enough votes to come up with a replacement?
Yeah, well, this healthcare debate has been full of surprises, so I'm never going to say never at this point. And I think right now, you know, you would need to do a little bit more in terms of cutting regulations to win over some conservatives, and you'd have to do a lot more funding for Medicaid, which covers low-income Americans, to win over the moderates. So it's a very narrow path, but senators, they just spent lunch with President Trump at the White House. They got a bit of a dressing down from him, where he said he's sitting there ready with his pen, and they went back to Capitol Hill to try and hash this out, and I think we'll see over the next week or so if they can actually come to some kind of conclusion, some kind of bill that satisfies 50 senators with a lot of very different views.
No sleep for you, though. Sarah Cliff from Vox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The markets today, we're feeling earnings season love. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Like Sarah just mentioned, before the latest CBO score dropped this afternoon, President Trump had invited Republican members of the Senate to the White House for lunch today. And he scolded them for not coming up with a workable plan to roll back Obamacare.
Inaction is not an option. And frankly, I don't think we should leave town unless we have a health insurance plan, unless we can give our people great health care, because we're close.
Likely not what the GOP leadership wanted to hear. Republican leadership seemed ready to move on to another big agenda item, tax reform. Plans to overhaul the tax code have been percolating in the background in D.C. The GOP wants sweeping cuts for individuals and businesses, but they've got to figure out how to pay for them. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Tax reform is just like health care reform in at least one way. If Republicans want to pass it without Democrats, it can't add too much to the deficit in the long term. But many tax analysts who've looked at the GOP proposals say the plans would add trillions. Lucia Smeal is a tax policy expert at Georgia State University. She says without the savings from repealing Obamacare,
the numbers for revenue neutrality in any tax reform don't look like they're going to work.
So what are the options if you still, say, want to lower the corporate tax rate to 20%? James Hines teaches law and economics at the University of Michigan.
You can cut spending. Easy to say, very hard to do. You can try to make the revenue up some other way with taxes.
Like the controversial border adjustment tax that would increase taxes on imported goods. Another idea? Move the goalposts, deficit neutral in 20 years instead of 10, or scrap some tax deductions and exemptions for individuals and businesses. And if all else fails, Columbia University tax law professor Alex Raskolnikov says magic.
So the magic revenue raiser is a 5% economic growth or 4% or whatever. You know, you can put any unrealistic number you want. And the higher the number you put, the more revenue it's going to generate, and that's going to balance the budget.
Magic tricks notwithstanding, Republicans will probably go for a mix of slightly lower tax rates, lots of spending cuts, and a hope the deficit hawks in the party will play along. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
It wasn't only health care and tax reform sucking up the air in D.C. today. The U.S. and China began trade talks, and there are clouds over these talks. North Korea, Chinese steel production. But the discussion, billed as economic dialogue, will likely tackle a whole host of issues. Where Chinese companies want access to our markets, where we want access to theirs. One big concern for U.S. tech companies are new hoops for firms that want to play on China's digital turf. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
The U.S. and China have a low-trust relationship, particularly when it comes to the web and snooping. Beijing has new cybersecurity rules, developed in part out of fears that the Chinese internet was being spied on by the American NSA, which of course was surveilling Americans. Kaiser Guo runs the Seneca podcast.
If the NSA was able to compel all these major American internet players to turn over personal information, what's to suggest that they are not doing exactly the same thing or worse when it comes to Chinese users?
The Chinese rules require international companies doing business there to use mainland servers and hardware and services, which they have to buy from Chinese companies, many of which are doing quite well, says Bill Bishop, publisher of the online newsletter Sinocism.
Chinese internet firms like Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, when you add up the market capitalization of all the Chinese internet companies that are public around the world, you're somewhere close to $1 trillion in market cap.
For U.S. firms like Google, the risk is not just doing business under Chinese rules, but also that Beijing gets its hands on your data, say private Gmail communication. That kind of thing has happened in China, says Kaiser Guo.
Yahoo was compelled to turn over email records of a dissident who then spent many years in prison as a result of this.
Still, no one is pure. The U.S. has also blocked Chinese tech investments here on grounds of national security. So in the digital economy, mutual protectionism may be the norm. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The Trump administration wants private investment to help pay for infrastructure spending, for roads, for bridges. The theory is that private investors will bankroll the upfront costs as long as they get a return on that investment. Texas embraced public-private partnerships over a decade ago. Tom Scheck from the investigative team at APM Reports has more.
In 2012, Texas Governor Rick Perry cut the ribbon on State Highway 130.
Today's proof that the concept is complete.
The concept was a public-private partnership. The grand opening was an I-told-you-so moment for Perry, who's now President Trump's energy secretary. Texas transportation officials wanted the 41-mile road between San Antonio and Austin for years to ease terrible traffic, but they couldn't fund it. When investors said they'd pay the $1.3 billion cost, Perry jumped.
And it can be seen. I mean, in concrete and asphalt, it can be seen now that it can be done.
But in return, drivers pay as much as $10 to use it, $40 for a tractor trailer. At a gas station near the highway, drivers have plenty to say about the tolls during rush hour.
It should be our right to use the road since it's built, and it, you know, we're already paying for it. To pay extra for every time you go on it seems criminal.
If I took 35 instead of the toll road to go to work, it would take me over an hour to get to work versus 40 minutes.
Kind of really the only mode unless you go down 35, you know, to get up there, and nobody likes sitting on 35, so they kind of got you cornered.
That was Kyle Busch, Bailey Savage, and DJ Shaw. Texans have seen a lot more tolls in the past two decades. Highway 130 is just one of 53. On some, everyone pays to drive. Others are so-called Lexus lanes. They run parallel to existing roads. Drivers buy a special pass. The toll roads have eased congestion, but Texans are getting fed up with it. In May, the Republican-controlled Texas House rejected a bill that would have allowed 10 new roads to possibly require tolls. Republican Jonathan Stickland voted against the measure.
My constituents hate it. This is not a right or a left issue. It's not a conservative or a liberal issue.
Public-private partnerships are a big issue for President Trump, who plans on more private investment, like that seen in Texas, to fuel his infrastructure plan. Details of the plan are not out, but it's possible projects will get priority or incentives if they tap private money. Terry Hall runs a group called Texans for Toll-Free Highways. She's a Republican who voted for Trump.
If you want to lose a voter, the fastest way you do it is to take $300 or $400 out of their pocket every month.
No one likes paying tolls. Mark Williams with the Texas Department of Transportation knows that. He says his department does all it can to avoid tolls, but he can easily list the benefits, like 10 new roads that he says wouldn't have been built or would have taken years longer without the tolling option.
For every $1 of public funding that went into those projects, about $3 of private financing was leveraged that would not have otherwise been available to advance those projects.
But using private money comes with risk. The owners of State Highway 130, the toll road Rick Perry vouched for, went bankrupt. Investors lost money, and the U.S. Department of Transportation got only a tiny fraction back from a huge loan for the project. The private operators also aren't so private anymore. Under the bankruptcy agreement, the federal government now owns a third of the company that runs the toll road. I'm Tom Scheck for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the coolest thing for me to find would be like a 60s or 70s scooter helmet.
Making bike helmets fashion forward. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 66 points, 0.3%, to finish at 21,640. The Nasdaq gained 40 points, 0.6%, to end at 6,385. And the S&P 500 added 13 points, 0.5%, to end at 2,473. Railroad operator CSX was a market darling when it reported strong earnings yesterday. But today it told investors to rein in expectations going forward. That sent its shares chugging down 5%. And a hot and spicy spicy merger today, McCormick is to buy RB Foods, maker of French's mustard. Gave heartburn to some investors today. McCormick lost 5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.27%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrian Hill. We're now in the second half of the Major League Baseball season. The Dodgers and Astros are pretty much in a league of their own. The Moneyball guys and their ilk in back offices are likely hard at work trying to figure out who to grab during this trading period. But there's not a lot of baseball going on screen. Where did the great Hollywood baseball movie go? That's the title of a recent piece in the New York Times Magazine. It's by J. Caspian Kang. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks.
Why has the great Hollywood baseball movie disappeared?
I think that a lot, like the rest of Hollywood right now, baseball movies are suffering from foreign rights and the idea that you can't really get a movie made with a big budget unless it sells in China or other parts of Asia. And I think baseball movies, even more so than other sports movies, don't really translate to international audiences. So it's very difficult to get funding for them. But I think on another level, our sentimental relationship with baseball might have changed over the past like 15 or 20 years. And I'm not sure that you can still make the same type of movie that you made in the late 80s and the early 90s, which is sort of like sentimentalized fathers and sons and the sort of middle Americana.
Is that because of the strike or is it something else? What else? What about our relationship with the sport itself has changed?
Yeah, starting in 1994, I think the strike and then sort of the steroid era, I think that it purged a lot of the sentimentality that comes along with it. I think there's also this thing which, you know, I certainly don't blame on the players at all or even on the economy of baseball where, you know, I think in the early 80s or in the 70s, you could sort of imagine that somebody that you grew up with who you could relate to would be playing on the field. But given the salaries of the players and how public they are and how rich they are, it's very difficult to make anything about sports that feels modern and current that doesn't discuss like the lifestyle of these players because you have to at some point address the fact that this guy is making like $20 million a year and that his life is very, very different from the person who's watching the sort of drama unfold.
That's interesting that we've sort of lost the ability to connect to these players in some way.
Yeah, and I think that some of it, unfortunately, is probably like about race as well. I mean, I think that since the 80s and 90s, the demographics of baseball has changed quite a bit, and that a lot of the star players are now from Latin America, and that baseball hasn't really done a good job of introducing these players to the rooting public. So I think that baseball itself has sort of lagged behind in trying to make a large portion of their player base accessible enough to like even feature in a movie, however silly.
And what about a great sports movie more broadly? As I was thinking about it, we're not seeing a ton of sports movies either, at least these schmaltzy sports movies of my childhood.
Yeah, I think that the NBA probably has the best shot at it because they have such a big fan base in China and around the world. But I just think that the NBA doesn't quite lend itself to being filmed in the same sort of way because you don't have the moment where like the guy walks out of the tunnel and then the field opens up in front of them and he gives like a speech about, you know, like this is the cathedral of my childhood and my father was like
the sun
was
shining
like a sardine
through the cloud
canner.
At the precise moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Onto his face.
So in the basketball arena, it would be like people shooting off t-shirt cannons and loud music. So I don't know if it translates. At least it wouldn't work for me as well, but maybe there are some people for whom that sort of scene has a lot of sentimentality.
J. Caspian Kang is a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine. Thanks.
Thanks.
We took a trip out of the studio not long ago, just a few blocks really, to downtown Los Angeles's bustling arts district. There's a new art gallery, a couple designy furniture and clothing stores, and in a small loft where you might find an artist living and working, we found the headquarters of Thousand. Thousand is a company that makes bicycle helmets for the Instagram conscious set. Think less sci-fi duck bill headgear and more Steve McQueen from the 1960s. The helmets run about $85. Gloria Huang is the co-founder and CEO of Thousand. She showed us to the roof of the building, where she holds a lot of her business meetings.
It's a good view. It used to be an even better view of downtown.
The rooftop is a maze of potted plants and art within full earshot of the planes and helicopters and trains of the city.
This building, I think, is 100 years old, and it's one of the only two live workspaces left in the Arts District. That's why a lot of creatives
are still here.
Yeah, are here in this building and the building next to us.
Gloria led us down a small, secret gardenish path.
It might not look like it's going to be something, but it'll be something when we walk through it.
To a small seating area covered with passion fruit vines. And I asked her how she came to be the CEO of a bicycle helmet company.
My story is I've been a longtime biker in Los Angeles, and I never wore a bike helmet. And if I'm honest, it's just because I just thought they looked kind of dorky. So, and it's not a good reason,
right,
but yeah. It was my reason. And then a friend of mine passed away from a really bad accident.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a headfirst injury. New York City wasn't wearing a bike helmet. And for me, I was just, afterwards, it was just that feeling of, I need to start wearing a bike helmet to be responsible to myself, to be responsible to people around me. And I went onto the market to find something I really liked and, you know, could kind of represent. And I think I found things I thought were kind of passable. And I really thought to myself, hey, you know, if you make a bike helmet people actually want to wear, I think you can, one, solve a public health crisis. You can prevent a lot of injuries and fatalities every year. And beyond that, I feel like you can really encourage cycling within cities because I thought people were like me, like the main reason they didn't want to bike was because they didn't want to feel unsafe. So if you could give people a way to feel safe, then maybe they'd bike more.
Did you have any experience with bike helmets or designing?
Not at all.
You're like, I just want to make a cool looking bike helmet. You know, trust me.
Yeah. You know what? My background was in philanthropy. I was actually former Tom's. So I was in the giving department there. And my job was trying to help things have social impact that the company was doing. So my background is trying to find new ways to do good in the world.
Right.
So the mission, that was my background, but design was not. Again, design was something I just had to learn to make this happen.
And describe your helmet. Like, how did you make, like, what's it look like for folks who can't see it?
Totally, yeah. So going back to the whole, like, equestrian vintage moto thing, really just try to put those two together. For me, it was thinking the coolest thing for me to find would be, like, a 60s or 70s scooter helmet in someone's basement. And can we take that concept and make it for today?
So you have this idea for design. I'm going to go back to that. You have this idea for design.
For sure.
You want it to look like this sort of vintage scooter helmet.
Yeah.
You still have to meet all these rules and regulations,
Totally.
I assume, about like keeping it safe. Like, it can't just look what actually has to do its job. How did you do that?
So the helmet development process takes a year and a half. You have to pass CPSC testing in the U.S., which is like 20 different tests. We also sell a lot in Europe, so we have to pass CE testing, which is an additional 20 other tests. So that whole testing process takes like 4 months. And the really crazy thing about bike helmets is you have to build everything to production level before you can test it. So that means you have to invest all of the money in design, all of the molds. You have to build the whole thing of what you're going to sell to the public, and before you can, you have to test it. And if that fails, you've got to go to the beginning.
So how much does it cost to develop a new helmet?
Minimum six figures.
Where did you guys come up with that?
While I was at Tom's, I had this idea, and I was like, okay, I'm going to start working nights and weekends on it. And I put together a Kickstarter concept. At the time, I was trying to raise 20 grand.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the campaign closed, we had close to $250,000.
Huh.
I actually thought Kickstarter was broken because pledges were coming in, but they were all from people I didn't know. Huh. So I just thought it was a systems glitch.
And are most of your sales coming direct through your website or coming through bike shops?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both. So a lot of the shops, number one, that we sell to aren't bike shops because we felt like...
That's interesting.
The customer experience in a bike shop... And our customer isn't going to bike shops a lot. Our customer rides a couple times a month. They're biking to work. They're not like bike aficionados.
Right.
We kind of fall into a more progressive area because we're thinking more about how do people behave nowadays than they did maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
How often do you think back to your friend who passed that sort of started this idea?
I would say really often. Like He actually hired me at Tom's.
Oh, really?
So
He hired me as an intern, and it was one of those things where when you're, like, young in your 20s, you don't really believe in yourself a lot. He was the first kind of grown-up that made me think I could and should believe in myself. So I think it's kind of, sorry.
No.
Again, creating something for him was it feels kind of full circle in a lot of ways. Because you just get the letters, and you're like, this is kind of worth it, you know? Just like, even one life saved, one hospital trip avoided, like, worth it.
Right. Gloria, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We've got photos of those helmets. That's at marketplace.org. And if you'd like to hear more conversations with founders and CEOs, check out our Corner Office podcast, hosted by Kai Rizdahl. There's a new episode out today. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. This final note before we go today, office romances. According to Fast Company, there's a new study that finds nearly 90% of Japanese workers support office flings, as long as they don't get in the way of actual work. Here in the U.S., we also find love around the coffee pot. In another survey, 10% of U.S. workers said they met their spouses at work. Today, the Dow was up 66 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq gained 40 points, 0.6%. And the S&P 500 added 13 points, 0.5%. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.